Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do.
Michael Hohmeyer back with us, legal specialist in business and corporate law. Hey, it's the law segment. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Michael Ray.
Did you bring your Prozac with you?
Oh, it's tough to stay mellow, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I'm watching what's going on, Michael, and I'm listening to both sides of the aisle, and I'm listening to the Obama side and the Boehner side. But the one thing that I have been noticing that's horrible, and it was about a day or so ago, that was one of the it was one of the elected officials. It was a congressman, and I'm sorry I didn't write the state down that he was from, but it was televised, so this is not hearsay. That he was talking to the NAACP and the Black Caucus, and he was basically talking about it. We're going back to the Jim Crow era, and don't let them make them. Don't let them make the African-American second-class citizens. So when they're losing the feel of a vote, then they pull the race card. So now that they're going to get people voting for them because the other side is racist, has nothing to do with the economy, the ability for this man to run this country, which he can't, or any of the other issues that we're facing today. And that's really hitting below the belt.
It really is, and it's unfortunately, it seems, part of a very sad history that we've seen developing over the last 2.5 years, very contrary to what we were sold when people were voting in the election in 2008, that we were going to get a unifier, not a divider, and we were all going to work together, and people weren't going to be pitting groups against each other. But that seems to be all that's happened over the last 2.5 years, that this administration, and when it had its allies in Congress, was pitting Americans of different groups against Americans in other groups. I don't think that's what the majority of the people want, of whatever race. And I think that that's going to become increasingly obvious, that it's an intolerable distraction from really the serious issues that need to be addressed, and that need to be addressed by all Americans working together. And I think all Americans want to work together and are ready to work together, and don't appreciate these kinds of divisive tactics.
No, as a matter of fact, the class warfare is going continuously. The man goes to, he goes to Martha's Vineyards, on a vacation that would cost a mint. It had to cost a mint. And then he comes back with, is it the Section 5 housing that allows everybody into a particular place? But what he wants to do is he wants to level the playing field and let, people who can't afford to be there because there's nothing more than wealthy white people there. That's where the problem is with this kind of rhetoric, and this is scary. Michael, somebody's going to die. Somebody's going to get hurt. Somebody's going to be left shot out in the street because the ignition of hate is going rampant in this administration.
It's very unfortunate whenever people try to divide in order to conquer. It flies in the face of the American experience, the point of which is to unite, to bring people who are individuals together and create something out of nothing that exists not because of geography, not because of religion, not because of class, but it exists because it's philosophy. People wanted to create this country out of a wilderness, not just a physical wilderness, but an intellectual wilderness. And that was a huge change 200 years ago. And I don't think that the American spirit has changed much since then, at least the spirit as it's held by most people. And they do not appreciate and indeed resent these kinds of divisive tactics, which are typically, but not always, played on as people lose any other card to play. This is all that they've got. The only way that the administration really has a hope, given the poll numbers today, if they remain the case tomorrow and through the election, the only chance they have of reelection is to pit Americans against each other out of fear. And that's going to require labeling, and it's going to require blackballing, and it's going to require mudslinging. We see that you know, Rick Perry is accused of being stupid, and Michelle Bachmann is accused of being a Christian, God forbid, et cetera. These are all name-calling. It's ad hominem attacks. It's because they're intellectually bankrupt. They can't justify the administration's history and the Democrats' history based on the last 4 or 6 years of economic performance. They have nothing else to play. This is the card they have left.
Michael, look what Ron Paul did. He sent out, you know, a newswire to any woman who's ever kissed Rick Perry. You know, they're looking for a problem to destroy him. I want to see somebody who will come in who's tough enough, A, to be a leader. I don't care what religion they, well, there is a religion I would not like them to be. But I don't care what religion that they are, what ethnicity that they are. The idea is get in there and do the job. And I believe this in my heart of hearts. Whether it, and by the way, the last thing I heard was Hillary's jumping in there, and she may go up against Obama, which is going to be a very interesting split with that Democratic ticket. But that said, once somebody gets to that position of power, and it's power, they're no longer a man, they're no longer a woman, they're no longer a Democrat, they're no longer a Republican, they're no longer anything. They are the most powerful person on this planet, and that's what they are. And you need somebody that understands how a business works, cash in, cash out, and when you're in trouble, what not to do, and has a team around him or her, has a team around them that knows how to keep us out of trouble and strong enough to stand toe-to-toe with anybody who is going to intimidate us in any way, shape, or form.
I'm 100% confident that the results of the election next year will be based upon performance. The actual performance, the past that we've had, and the promise of more of the same for the next 4 years, or the promise of a different course for the next 4 years. I don't think that people are going to make up their mind based on racism. I don't think people are going to make up their mind based on class. I don't think people are going to make up their mind based on tax envy. I think people are going to make up their mind because they think that there are important issues beyond those distractions. That we don't have time to waste our attention on, that we need to be focused on reviving this economy, returning to our past traditions, and reclaiming the economic vibrancy and success that I believe is just sitting out there like low-hanging fruit, waiting to be plucked from the bottom limb of the tree if we will only reach out our arm to take it. And, of course, doing so requires a drastic reversal from what we've done over the last 4 to 6 years. But people will be making their decisions based on the right kinds of issues, economics, foreign policy. Are you happy with where things are, how things have gone over the last 4 to 6 years, and do you want them to go on in that way or in a different way? Those are going to be valid reasons for making a political decision next year, and I believe that will give increased legitimacy to whomever is elected president, and I don't believe it'll be a re-election.
Here's my concern. The concern is we have a particular society that generated a culture. That culture has been here since basically day one. It is a Judeo-Christian ethic any way that you look at it. If you move, if you maneuver other philosophies, other ideologies within the construct of the government in and of itself, you begin to change things, the Sharia law that in some of the different states are starting to look at to take on. 2006, Keith Ellison became the first Muslim elected in the United States Congress, and he was sworn in on a Quran. Now, I have no problem with that if it's not going to be what it is that we're doing. If you swear to something, then it's got to be in conjunction with the law of the land, not a religious law, the law of the land. The Bible in itself was a, or is, symbolically, the Judeo-Christian ethic that we created this country with. You know, you and I have talked about it before. I'm Jewish, but I was raised, everybody that I was raised around was, for the most part, Catholic. And I celebrated Christmas, and I sang Christmas carols in schools and so on and so forth. I wasn't standing out there with the ACLU screaming and complaining that I was emotionally upset because they didn't look at me. That's not where it is. If we don't want the country the way that it's been to develop into America that has enough jobs, enough housing, enough food, enough to put on the table to help everybody, then quit now and then let somebody else come in and take over. You don't come to a country that when you run away from another country because you were frightened to death of being killed, being tortured, being raped, whatever the case may be, and come here to be safe. And then within a month, a year, turn around and try to make the country here like what you ran away from. I don't get this. I don't understand the logic.
The Judeo-Christian tradition is a tradition of tolerance and a tradition of acceptance, and it is a tradition when practiced in its truest forms, if I can actually say that, but I think as a generalization it is correct, that embraces the idea of a separation of church and state, render unto Caesar versus, you know, render unto God, and also the idea of allowing disparate religious views and religions themselves to flourish on American soil together, all at the same time. That's been our tradition for 200 years for the most part, with exceptions to every general rule, but still that's been the Judeo-Christian tradition that's given us this tradition of religious tolerance that has matched so well with Americanism, and that allows us, if we will not be distracted by those who seek to divide on the basis of religion or on the basis of wealth or on the basis of class or on the basis of race or on the all these other silly little bases. But instead, we say, look, there are serious issues facing us. And on those issues, it doesn't matter whether you're Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, or whatever, or not. But you can say to yourself, I care about the economy. I care about national security. And these are issues on which there are serious issues, and we need to be spending our time on what's really the major issues of the day and not be distracted by these people who have no other card to play than division, who are trying to pit the house against itself in order to make sure that it does not stand. I think that that division strategy will fail this administration as it has failed his party in the last election, and all those who have tried to prevail by using division and divisiveness. It's as a smokescreen for distracting from the real issues of the day. These issues are too serious. They are life and death issues. In my business law practice, I have seen the horribly constricting effect of a terrible economy and wrong-headed economic views on the ability of my clients to start and grow their businesses, to hire people and put fellow Americans to work. My clients, as well as myself personally, are desperate for a return to traditional American values. I don't believe that they're going to allow themselves to be distracted by the policies of division. I just don't believe it.
Now, by the way, we're running out of time, Michael, but the one thing that I do want to say is this. NBC recently, they banned wearing an American flag or, the lapel, the sign on your coat or your jacket. And the reason that they did that they didn't want to go one side or the other with a cause. Where did they get the United States of America is a cause, and to ban that and not allow the flag to be shown? My feeling is this. Whatever it comes down to, I'm an American. I'm a former Marine. I love this country. I will do a Pledge of Allegiance. I will sing the national anthem, and I'm not embarrassed about it in any way, shape, or form, and it has nothing to do with taking someone else and pushing them under the rug so I can have what I want. This is the country that you come to, then follow the rules. You can't follow the rules, go away.
You know, NBC isn't going to win itself any friends or viewers with wrong-headed and silly politics like that. People, Republicans and Democrats, and those of no party, the independents, they're all generally agreeable on the concept. We love this country. It's an exceptional country, and the people in it that have made it exceptional and that are going to continue to return it to its exceptional course are not embarrassed about wearing the flag. It's a symbol that unites everybody, and it speaks to everybody. And again, the policies of division, whether they're practiced by the administration or by NBC, are not going to be embraced by a majority of this country. And if people don't believe that, they're going to find that out next year.
No question about it. Michael, we got to go. And a website we can find you at?
We're at www.homeierlaw.com, spelled HOMEIERLAW.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Michael, thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
My pleasure. Look forward to it already.
Take care. Good night. Hey.
Bye, Michael Ray.
And wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Gay Culverhouse with us, former president of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. She's the author of Throwaway Players, the concussion crisis from Pee-wee football to the NFL. She's responsible for the presence of an independent neurologist on the sidelines of every NFL game. Her advocacy work has been featured in the New York Times, ESPN, PBS. She's the author of, again, The Throwaway Players, The Concussion Crisis, Pee-wee Football to NFL. And Gay, welcome to the show.
Well, I certainly appreciate your having me tonight.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, this is an issue that we just took for granted for so many years. You know, these guys, they get out there, and that's a tough game. There's no question about that. And they get thrown around, and they get beaten up. You know, I played football when I was in high school, obviously not professionally. But at the same time, there is that element that if you get hit hard enough and if you get hit in the right place, your life is over. You could end up in a wheelchair for the rest of your life.
Well, and that happens. Unfortunately, it happens at all ages. You may have seen that on August 22nd, a 17-year-old high school player out of Maryland was on the field and was hit and was killed.
Yeah, no question. But I think really what we have to look at here is, you know, you can have the neurologist on the sidelines. Football is a tough game, any way you look at it. And the key is this is going, this, I'm not going to say it could happen. This is going to happen out there. What do you do? Is it, you know, do you have better equipment? Do you have football helmets that have more protection? Because if we don't, then the game shouldn't be played.
Well, there are two responses I have to that. One, the NFL is making a number of rules that were instituted last season and this season to make the game safer. For example, no helmet-on-helmet contact. They've changed the kickoff. They've put rules in place to make the game safer. And interestingly, the people that complain the most when those safety rules are put into place are the fans. The fans enjoy the violence of the game. And when we make it safer, they object. And that's a sad commentary on us as humans, but we've been doing it since the gladiators. We've been sitting in our boxes, drinking wine, beer, having hors d'oeuvres, and watching men beat each other up. And when you look at the names of the teams, the Bears, the Panthers, the Jaguars, we're not far from where we were thousands of years ago in many aspects. In terms of making the equipment safer, one thing you have to understand about concussions is you don't actually have to be hit to suffer a concussion. You can have a whiplash, which has exactly the same effect of throwing your brain against the front part of the skull and it ricocheting and hitting the back part of the skull. And so that is as fierce a concussion as a helmet-on-helmet contact. So you can have concussions without having, you know, a helmet on, without having actual contact.
Now, by the way, when we deal with this, and when we go back, you know, to the gladiators, I mean, that was to the death. There's no question about that. And what we have out, and again, I was in high school. I played football. You were out there, and you were going to get them. And the tougher you got, the better it was. And everybody up in the stands were screaming and yelling and going for it. I would even look at, as far as violence goes, look at boxing. Boxing, it's a skilled sport. But when you really come down to it, look what they've turned it into. Not necessarily boxing, but when they've gone on to these
in the cage fights.
Yeah. I mean, those guys are just—they're close to, quote unquote, close to death. I mean, they're except for getting hit in the groin, there's nothing that they don't do. They throw people down, they punch them out, and they do all of this stuff, and people love it. And as long as there's a dollar made, it's going to continue on.
And you can see in places like Las Vegas, this is replacing most of the entertainment. I was out in Vegas not long ago, and I know a young man who trains as an ultimate fighter. And it's funny because they gave him the head safety lecture, and he was laughing with me the other night. And he said, they had us out there for a weekend teaching us about head safety, but our job is to go out there and ram people's heads to get them to knock out, to get a concussed person on the mat so that we win. And that ultra-violent sport is eclipsing all of the tame aspects, if you will, about two-minute rounds in boxing.
Yeah, now, by the way, let's take it to wrestling for a moment. You know, the steroids, the hormones, the rest of it that they use, and these guys don't get a break. You know, as they're flying off the top of the ropes, you know, halfway across the ring and landing on someone. Now, a lot of it, if you watch very closely and if you're there, you can see a lot of it is just not quite as violent as they make it out to be. But still, these guys are going night after night after night, 12 months a year, and they've got to have something to keep them rolling. So there goes the drugs, and audience approval, and that's what they get.
You're absolutely right. And I'll tell you an interesting fact that I learned in researching this book. The average age that a player starts using a performance-enhancing substance is age 14.
Wow.
And the person that usually secures it is the mother or the older brother.
That's interesting.
And the moms get it. The moms usually go for the human growth hormone, and they tell the doctors their son should be taller, and they talk these doctors into giving it to them. The older brothers usually give anabolic steroids because those are more readily available on the black market. But it's a trickle-down from college and from the pros. And when you look at it, you know, the 14-year-old wants to play on the high school team, so he's got to be bigger and faster. The high school player wants to make it to the Ducks or the Gators, so he takes it to be bigger and stronger and faster. And then you're in college, you need to get to the NFL, the ultimate brass ring. So you enhance your program of performance enhancement so that you can reach the top brass ring. And once you're in the NFL, you've got to keep it up or you'll be eclipsed by the next college recruit.
And in the dollars that they get, you know, as a matter of fact, that's interesting also. When you go through that process, there is a social element of growing up that these kids miss. And they miss it because they become heroes. They become above and beyond reproachable, and they're making, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And there's that area in their life that they don't get, which makes them extremely vulnerable if they do get hit. Now, here's the big question: how do we protect the youngsters coming up from this? How do we alert them in such a way that they're not just hearing it, and yet the value for going through this and being quote unquote as brutal as they can is going to get them paid and make them famous?
Well, you know, it's a tough job to try to do it. I've watched my 7-year-old grandson, and I've learned a lot from watching him. But what I think we've got to do, quite honestly, is start with this generation of 7-8-year-olds, because that's when you enter Pee-wee. That's when you enter the league, if you will. And we've got to train them to put the I back in team. You know the old phrase, there is no I in team. My belief is we have to put the I back in team. We've got to teach children to self-identify when they've been concussed. And it's very easy to know. If you ask anyone who's had a concussion, they knew immediately. They saw stars. Their vision was blurred. They wanted to vomit. They had ringing in their ears. If you get to that point, you know something's wrong. So instead of staying in the game, self-identify, tell your coach, tell your mother or father, and get yourself out so you can heal that brain. If we train this young group of kids and bring them up through the ages, we should set the new generation of safety. And I've got a program called Headstrong Player that has videos and a curriculum so that YMCA's, Boys Club, Pee Wee Leagues, Pop Warner, everyone can use it. It's for soccer players and any sports kids. But it teaches them to put the I in team and self-identify.
Now, by the way, as we go along here, when we are dealing with this, I want to make sure that we talk about the very important, the Players Outreach, the program, and it's the retired NFL players getting their benefits, etc. You got a lot of players that were hit hard, and it's almost like coming back from military, coming back from combat, and they don't really get the attention that they should get because they've, quote-unquote,
right,
put their life out on the line for people, and it happened to have been entertainment, which we will pay hundreds of millions plus dollars for. And they need to be taken care of also. So as an outsider, how can I help with the outreach program?
Well, I appreciate your asking that question. If you can let people know that it exists, that's the main thing we need right now. I mean, of course, we always need funding, but what we are doing is trying to reach every former NFL player and let him know what the benefits are that the NFL offers to them. Unfortunately, when they retire, they don't leave a forwarding address with the NFL. And they could be in too bad a shape to leave a forwarding address, but the thing is, the NFL offers many programs for retired players. What we do is we go around the country and alert the retired players what their benefits are, and then we help the player access those funds, whether we have to provide medical testing or clerical support or whatever we have to do, we do for free to alert the players and match them with the NFL program that's available. And with the new CBA, there is more than $88,000 per year available for assisted living. It's now $104,000 available for assisted living. And there are all sorts of screening processes for heart disease, prostate cancer. There are a myriad of programs that the NFL is offering. We just need the players to be able to know about them and take advantage of them.
Well, let me ask you this. We're starting to run out of time now. Where is it that we can find you, a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's www.playersoutreach.org.
Okay, www.playersoutreach.org. Gay, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight, and good luck. I think it's a great thing that you're doing.
Well, I certainly appreciate your help.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Good night.
Good night.
I'll go my way by myself. This is the end of romance. I'm gonna go my way by myself. Love is only a dance. I'll try to apply myself. Teach my heart how to sing. Yeah, you can bet I'll go my way by myself. Like a bird on the...
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I'll face the unknown. I'll build a world all my own. There ain't nobody...
Jim Warner with us. He's the co-author of The Drama-Free Office, A Guide to Healthy Collaboration with Your Team, Co-Works, and Your Boss. He began his entrepreneurial career at age 29. He founded a software company, Precision Visuals, Inc. He evolved quickly from developer to entrepreneur to leader, experiencing the full range of business transitions, high growth, team building, recessions, downsizing, restructuring, repositioning, succession planning, and implementation. And since 1995, he's worked with over 2,500 CEOs in multinational public companies, entrepreneurships, partnerships, and family businesses. As an advisor to top executives, he's an expert on how to expand their suite of leadership skills while breeding enduring authenticity and collaboration within their teams. And let us say hi, Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Jim, you know, the one thing, how do we get through an office in a day without the drama? Because without the drama, it seems that they don't go home with any kind of badge of honor.
Well, but drama is pervasive in almost any office environment you're going to encounter. And our guidance to listeners is make sure that you're out of it yourself. So if the drama is being played out on a stage in your office, choose to be in the audience versus being a participant.
Now, by the way, when we deal with drama, you know, there's so many offices that have drama. People come to work, they bring their stuff to work, and they don't seem to realize that there's a distinction between when they're at home and when they're getting paid to do a particular job. And I would venture to guess, and I'm quite confident with all of your experience, with enough drama within an organization, within an office, it affects the bottom line. The income that's supposed to be there gets hit and it gets diluted.
Yeah, we actually look at drama as any behavior that drains energy or blocks clean, authentic interactions. And whenever that happens, you're going to inhibit creativity and productivity in organizations, and that has a direct impact on bottom line. So that's why we really advocate our work starting top down with the most senior people committing to be drama free.
Okay, now, by the way, how do you deal with that with somebody who is running the place? You know, I'm sure you're going to run up against a lot of egos that won't even, number one, admit to it. But once you clear that, how do you work through that to go to the trickle-down effect?
Well, you're correct that it must start with the top person. We've been privileged in our work to be able to have the confidence and trust of those top people who desire to have more authentic relationships and collaborative work in their organizations. And we say before we can take it down to your staff, it must start with you for you to get out of your own drama. And so we say anytime you find yourself in a complaining mode, there's four basic types: complaining, cynicism, controlling, and being the pleaser or noncommittal person. And so we help the senior person, and then by trickle-down effect, all in his organization, first get clear on which of the different drama types do you tend to fall into. And then we give them antidotes to catch themselves before they fall into the trap of drama.
Now, by the way, a lot of this has to do with quote unquote the leader, and there's no question about that person that's absolutely at the top. And if that person is at the top is truly a leader, or they know what skills that they don't have that has hired a leader, now all of a sudden it's a different world, because when we are dealing with a leader, it's somebody who's going to bring people together, collectively bring people together, mobilizing people to effectively move in one direction. And many, many businesses today do not have that.
Yes. And what we advocate for leaders is, first of all, to be open to feedback from any form you can get it, to stay curious about how can you improve not only your domain skills in your enterprise, but also your interaction skills so you can breed collaboration among your people and delegate and empower versus having to micromanage. So the first step we encourage for leaders is to take a drama assessment. Sometimes we call ourselves the drama doctors, and we've created a diagnostic that they can use online, which essentially diagnoses the type of drama they are most prone to fall into. Once you know the type, the complainer, cynic, controller, or caretaker, then you can then take specific steps so you don't fall into that trap.
One of the things that I've seen over the years, and the people that fall into that trap are old school. You know, it's the command and control. And today we've transitioned to, you said it, we've transitioned to collaboration. We want employees. We want employees to be part and parcel of the business. They don't have to be involved in the in the profit of itself, but they've got to be involved in the business in such a way that they feel it's part of them and they're recognized for what they put into that business so the business gains.
Yeah, and all people in an organization are desiring some type of recognition. They also want, most of the people we run into really desire to do a good job for the organization. And when they can be given their own, I call it sandbox to play in, be able to be delegated and empowered to do their job, and then get a sense of recognition for that, they normally will operate at very high levels. It's superiors who get caught up in having to micromanage and control, who have to be right all of the time, impose their agenda and ego on the rest of their teams, that begin to stunt the creativity and productivity of their teams, and that's what creates drama.
Now, by the way, I think one of the hardest things, and it's in your press release, that you have to deal with, in the general sense of the word of you, is the risk of confronting drama-prone people. There's got to be a method to do so, because you just can't walk up and do it. You'll create havoc like you've never seen before.
Yes, and we advocate a couple steps for that. The first is, if you have someone who's caught in drama, again, they're a chronic complainer or gossip or the micromanager type, or someone caught in, you know, cynicism, the Eeyore of the office, the first step is actually antithetical. We actually encourage you to build rapport with them. Take a softer approach. Find things to like in them. Actually begin to build some trust. When you do build trust, you then have a chance to suggest different behaviors that would be more productive for the group. The second step when you find someone caught in drama is to put yourself in their shoes. Oftentimes, they may have a difficult home environment. They may have their own boss who's putting extraordinary pressure on them to perform. So as you put yourself in their shoes, you begin to empathize with them, build rapport, and then you have a chance to have an influence on their behavior. The other key point is to don't go into this from an emotionless place. If you let emotion overtake you in your exchanges with someone in drama, it's like 2 5-year-olds on the playground having a discussion. So get out of the emotional component of it and say, what are my options for dealing with this person in a clean fashion?
You know, an interesting thing happened to me just now, that I was looking at this, and then I realized your co-author is your daughter. So the question, Jim, the question really would be with Kaylee, that and everybody who puts anything to pen goes through this, whether it's fact, fun, fiction, whatever, there comes that part in the book that they begin to realize a dimension of the subject matter that they weren't aware of. And especially with the two of you being close, where was it that you two had a look at each other and realized there was more to what you thought it was?
Well, when we had worked with a couple hundred teams together, we began to see the patterns arising in these teams where energy got sucked out of organizations. And we got back and we began to look for patterns and distilled it down to these 4 different drama types. And then over the years, we developed these different methods of being able to puncture the drama and get people back to an authentic place. So So it probably took us about 5 to 7 years before we were able to distill down what we'd seen in the marketplace and put it down into the diagnostics and then the tools for dispelling the trauma. It was interesting, Michael, in our own creation of the book, we ran into our own drama. I'd get frustrated at her of how she would redline some of my writing. She'd get frustrated at me when I would micromanage or demand, you know, she meet tighter deadlines. And we'd have to catch ourselves, take a deep breath, pause, own that part of the drama that we had created. And when we could own it, we could begin to laugh at it. And then what we say is we began to push the reset button and go back to mature behavior. So we had to deal with it ourselves in the creation of the book.
That's where I was going with that, because it's a learning process. And when you write about something, it's got to be something within you that you've conquered at one time or another. But as you really dig into it, and especially if it's family that you're dealing with, this stuff's going to come up. You get to look at it. And what that does, it puts a dimension into the writing that you wouldn't have had before.
Very much so, as a father-daughter team and raising my other children, that letting go of my need to be right, especially as a parent raising elementary and middle school children, especially and challenging teenagers, I wanted to impose my control and my will on them. And my third teenager that began to realize that wasn't working. And a softer, more collaborative approach, letting them make decisions, letting my children be my teacher, helped me build greater rapport with them, so when I did want to shoot that silver bullet to get something across to them, I'd built up enough relational capital that they would really listen. And interestingly, that was extrapolatable into the business space.
You know, it's wonderful, because I'm going to go back to where it was a few minutes ago, whenever it was, the command and the control versus collaboration. And what you just said is you transitioned, and when you transitioned, you realize the transition because of the challenge and the obstacles that came up between the two of you and how critical collaboration is.
And to get to that place, it required setting aside the ego. And the ego wants three things: to be in control, to be recognized and approved, and to prove that I'm right. Yeah. All three of those drain energy, and they end up having warring silos as opposed to collaborative interaction. And so much of our work is getting people to let go of your need to control, let go of your need to even be approved or liked, and especially the need to be right. Would you rather be effective or be right?
Yeah, by the way, interesting point. And there's so many people who would rather be right because they've lived their entire lives with somebody telling them they're wrong, and they're going to go out of their way to prove they're right until they can come up against it and begin to realize that proving yourself right is not right.
Well, look at our education system. You have to get into the right schools, raise the right, you know, wear the right clothes, hang out with the right friends, drive the right car. And especially if you look at the legal profession, it's to prove I'm right, you're wrong, win, lose. If you can let go of the win, lose, and just go out and play the game in a collaborative fashion, we find curiosity, creativity rise enormously. So it's actually undoing a lot of our learning from childhood.
Oh, by the way, I have a great recommendation for you. I think that it would be extremely important if your daughter and yourself took the book, gave it to our politicians in Washington, and had them take a look at it and learn.
We've thought of that also in churches, in hospital settings, all nonprofit settings, the educational system in schools. The principles are universal. We chose to go in the office environment first because that had been our primary experience. If there's a sequel to the book, it would be the drama-free family or the drama-free nonprofit.
I really think the drama-free government, and I'm not getting political with you. It's not left or right. That's not where I'm at with this. Both sides have the same problems. They're not collaborating, and that's where the problem is. And I really believe that the essence of what you're teaching the businesses should be taught, yes, in school, yes, in government. But, well, actually, if you taught it in school, those kids that went on to become elected officials would automatically have that inherent within their ability to deal with people.
totally agree with you. If we had a drama-free government, a place of collaboration, and setting aside my agenda, things like the debt crisis, the economic issues we're facing now, health care, immigration, I'm convinced you could get to win-win solutions. There will be some stretching by both sides, some potential pain, and now here's the tough word, some vulnerability. And so if government officials or family members or school officials are willing to go to those places, then you can get to synergistic exchanges and solutions. The problem is this need to be right is so rooted deeply in our culture. One of our challenges as authors and consultants is to help unroot that and get people into a collaborative space.
Okay, and what you're really dealing with, and I'm a very firm believer in this, is the rule basically is this. The rule is, to stem to where I'm going with this, is that a good teacher knows when to be a student and a good leader knows when to follow. You know, I probably change hats 4 or 5 times a week, you know, with this. And the idea here is when you are doing what you do, when people begin to realize that you're moving towards the same goal, things start to work out. And it takes somebody who's been there, done that, to look over your shoulder and to say, hey, this is what you're missing. This is an opportunity that you're not seeing. That basic foundation that people make decisions from, businesses make decisions from. If you look deep into it and if you're not there, you can take a look and see what they don't see. And I really believe that's what you're doing.
Yes. Yep. And if we can empower leaders, the phrase we use is to lead from a step behind, not care who gets the credit. Empower and cheer for your subordinates. Be the wind beneath their wings. Magic can happen. To do that requires creation of trust. We've got the following definition of trust I'd like to share with you. It's credibility plus reliability. You get things done on time, plus adaptability. You can change your agenda. You can be flexible, divided by self-interest. So the key is, can I set aside my self-interest and look for the good of my team as opposed to my own agenda?
Makes sense to me. Jim, we're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, thank you for asking. It's www.dramafreeoffice.com. And one thing that we found to be very popular on that site is a free drama diagnostic survey where in 10 minutes you can assess very quickly the type of drama in both yourself or your coworkers.
What a great idea.
Been very popular. It takes only 10 minutes, and it's free.
Wonderful. I had said what a great idea. I think it's phenomenal. Jim, thank you
so much.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael, thank you for having me on again, especially for your championing the idea of a collaborative world. I appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Good night now.
You'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a wannabe, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. for you. Leave me. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Welcome back on Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Die. Death, where are we?
Whatever you've done, it's all over.
Drama. I knew it. It's right there. The English is coming. How one language is sweeping the world. Our guest author is Leslie Dunton Downer. Leslie's a former lecturer at Harvard University. She holds a PhD in comparative literature from Harvard and co-authored the acclaimed Essential Shakespeare Handbook. And let us say hi, Leslie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I want to read the first couple of sentences in your press release because that really says it all. And I would venture to guess that most people have no idea about this. There are currently 6,000 languages spoken on the planet, and yet you can utter the word hello virtually anywhere from Timbuktu to multinational space station, and you can be understood. English has fast become the number one language for everything from business, science, diplomacy and education, entertainment and environmentalism to socializing and beyond. Leslie, it's kind of a surprise because we have such a fight to keep it constant right here in the country. I think that's amazing and wonderful.
Yeah, that's a funny thing that you actually bring that up because I wondered about whether the very fact that English is not officially the national language for the United States and the fact that we have to kind of talk about language in this country and which language are we going to use in our classrooms and our communities and think about English in so many different ways, whether that's part of the story of the vitality of the language that's made it so interesting to people around the world. I wonder if there's a connection between that, but I don't know if people have actually answered that question.
And I really wonder if people, you know, I'm a little bit surprised because I hadn't thought about it until I took a look at the press release and read what I just read. And I thought that's kind of an interesting thing because we have so many challenges with the language here in this country. And yet at the same time, as you said, it's growing rapidly. Where was it that you saw that or the light bulb went on to realize that English is spreading?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Obviously not in the United States, because as you say, you know, here in the United States, we sort of take it for granted, but we also have around 2 million people who are American citizens who don't yet have mastery of the language, and even more people who are living in the United States who don't speak English fluently, and yet at the same time, there are exponentially growing numbers of people around the world who are trying to learn English as fast as they can. And you see them, the way I became interested in this topic as, you know, somebody who watches languages around the world and listens and tries to learn some of them and then is aware of how languages is, you know, used in different contexts in different countries. I think one of the light bulb moments for me was being on a train in Eastern Europe and hearing kids who were from the Czech Republic interacting with kids who were from Turkey and from France and from other countries. Nobody in the group that I was listening to was from an English-speaking country, and they were all young people who were interested in music and culture, and they wanted to talk about their holiday time, and they were on a train, and they had a few hours together, and they immediately started conversing in English, and there was no question that that was the language they were going to use. And, you know, they ended up being able to talk about films and music and their travel plans in English. It was sometimes broken English, but that was a pretty surprising moment because that was a place where not so long ago you would have heard German as the first language to try. And all of a sudden, here we are with a generation where English is the automatic go-to language. No one even questioned it.
And let's talk technology for a moment. I have watched my sister get into some of these different groups on the internet. And obviously they speak English, and she has no idea when she'll make a comment, et cetera, and somebody fires back at her or agrees with her, whatever the case may be, if they're even in the country. And I'm wondering if, you know, the texting, the internet, the rest of it hasn't caused a base of this to be.
Yeah, well, obviously this is an area of huge fascination to people who are involved with language and language change. It's just how this technology is changing the language and how technology has changed languages in the past, like how printing technology changed language or even radio and television. These are major influences. And the internet is an interesting example because you have these individual people talking to one another, as you say, not necessarily even knowing where they are. And sometimes using, you know, often using English in a way that is kind of broken, and you can't tell. Well, maybe they were just in a hurry, so they were dropping some words because they were in a rush, or it's because they don't really know how to use the language in the same way that a native speaker would. But no one seems to really mind, because I think that there's a kind of ethic of efficiency and, you know, getting your message across. So people don't stop and necessarily say, "Hey, you forgot to, you know, use this particular grammatically correct phrase." If you're a native speaker, I don't think people go out and kind of correct other people. We understand that if you're involved in a conversation that's happening on a global scale, that there's a different kind of set of standards that are in place for that.
Now, by the way, there's constants, and with anything else, there's overarching themes, words, etc. You got about 30 words and phrases that are familiar to people all over the planet. Now, where did you start to develop those? And I won't say, you know, what are the 30 words, but just a few of them. What are some of those words that have that commonality that no matter where you go, you're going to hear them?
Yeah, well, like technology, you just brought that up. So obviously some of the words that are very familiar to people all over the world come out of the technology that delivered those words, and they need the words because it's tied intimately to the English-speaking technology like the Internet. So you have words like blog. Absolutely everywhere that you have Internet technology, you've got the word blog, even if in some languages it's officially not a word. Say in French, blog is apparently not, it's not been voted in by the Language Academy, but people still use it. It's an actually used word. And then you have words like computer port as a phrase, a computer port. People will use that phrase all over in Arabic. If you're in a market in Cairo and you're trying to get your computer port fixed, you're going to hear people speaking Arabic and they'll insert the words computer port for the idea of that. Then there are words that are from you know, different aspects of life. I think an interesting one is shampoo. All over the world, whether you're in Japan or in China or in India, you'll find that you can buy something called shampoo, and it in fact is a word that comes from English, and yet English borrowed it from Hindi. So it was originally an ancient Indian word that had to do with massaging the scalp in an ancient Indian ritual way. So those are interesting examples of, you know, English distributing these words to people all over the world, and sometimes these words come from English itself, like a native word that English has had for 1,500 years since the language was first emerging as an independent language. Say a word like business. People all over the world know the word business in almost every language. People will recognize the word business and even use it in their own language. And then there are words that English has borrowed from other languages that it has also spread around now on a global scale.
You know, one of the things that I've learned over the years, and I thought it was fascinating years back, English happens to be the hardest language to learn because of all the dialects and all the idioms. Here, I'm going to set you up for this one, so know you're being set up before it happens, okay?
Okay.
So what does the word chake mean?
The word?
Chake.
Shake?
Chake. Chake.
How are you spelling it?
Oh no! The spelling will give it away. But the word, have you ever heard the word before? Chake.
I'm not sure I have.
Okay. Now, this is how it's used. Well, is Sam there? Well, let me go out in the backyard and chake. You know, that's where the problem is. It's the word check. But the key is, yeah. The key is that's why it is so hard to learn our language because of the idioms and all of the dialects and all of the, you know, as Southern, you go to Boston, you go to New York, California, the Midwest. That's why it's very hard to learn this language.
Yeah, you go across Massachusetts Avenue where I live, and in a different neighborhood, people speak a different way. You're absolutely right. But at the same time, there are things about English that make it very easy for people to learn on a functional basis. And one of those things is that we don't have a complicated, inflected grammar in English where people have to learn many different ways of saying the word the, for example. You don't have to learn 12 different versions of the word the, depending on whether you're talking about an object that is masculine or feminine or neuter or in a subject position or an object position or evocative. I mean, imagine in so many different other languages where those inflections are very complicated and difficult to learn. And we also know from different situations around the world where people have a choice of speaking different languages and opt for English over another language because it's easier to get their point across, that it's a language where people feel comfortable using the language and not worrying too much about getting things wrong. I mean, I think we have a tradition in the English language of, in most contexts that we're talking about, not being too judgmental. So you can have a diplomat, for example, using English, or say someone in a conference or in a business meeting using English, and the other speakers around that meeting won't necessarily think, oh, you know, you have no mastery of our language, so you should probably start speaking it now before you massacre it anymore. But there are other languages in the world where those kinds of mistakes, if you add them up, very quickly amount to somebody feeling pretty, not very confident about going into much depth in the language. So I think that is an issue that English is well equipped to deal with.
Well, absolutely, and I really believe in my heart of hearts, if you take a look at, even though our economy is going into the dumper right now, I mean, there's no question about that, but even so, we're going to bounce back, we're going to be doing some other things, and cyclically, historically, America has always bounced back no matter what's gone on, and the world knows this. No matter what kind of rhetoric we get, the world does know this, and having a base of English is going to mean something for people, whether it's going to be survival, economic use, or whatever the case may be. It is a very powerful language to get used to because it's here, it's going to be here, and I don't think it's ever going to be gone.
Well, I have to say, I think you're right that native speakers of English in the United States have a leg up. These people who have the advantage of speaking English as a native language are lucky, and they should use that as an advantage in the way that it offers an opportunity for them to be involved in lots of global conversations with people who don't speak English as a native language. So I think the thing that's interesting to see around the world is, there's so many people. We're way outnumbered in America. There are many people around the world who are learning to speak English, so many that that the number of people who have learned English way outnumbers the number of people who've grown up speaking it. So it gives the English speaker access to a very large community. It's the first time in the history of the world that we've had a language which has this planetary scope where you learn the language and it gives you access to people all around the world. And you can use that for all kinds of things, including business and economic growth. So I think it would be really good for people who know English here in the United States to look for opportunities like your wife of using the language in places where they have interactions with people who are in other countries or who don't speak English as a first language, and that will help to broaden their opportunities and get them outside of their immediate community of English speakers.
Now, by the way, Leslie, let me ask you this: when you go right down to the core, and when you saw and you felt, you experienced what was going on with English, what really is it for the average person? What do you want them to grasp, to get their arms around, to take away from this?
Well, one thing that really I hope people will appreciate from the book is that that English is a language which has been very, very plastic and changing over its 1,500 years, and it's likely to be a language that changes a lot over the course of the coming generations. not least because of this new technology and the new position of the language in this international global context. And it's a very exciting time to be a native speaker of English and to be someone who's learning the language. So I think there's an excitement about the language, the same way that in Shakespeare's time, people were in a period there where the language was changing so quickly because of contact that English speakers were having with the New World and with the Orient and with writers who were long dead but being translated into English and printed in printing presses. And there's so many changes that happened during Shakespeare's lifetime that were massive for the language, that were very exciting and hotly debated. And I think we're in one of those periods right now. There are going to be a lot of changes happening with English, and some of them may be happening a little too fast for some people, and some of them may be pretty extreme. But I think this is all a sign of the time that we're living in, and it's a time where, you know, people should take an interest in their language. It's a very powerful language, and it offers a lot of opportunities and also a lot of challenges in the coming generation. So it's a time to become more aware of what you can do with English.
Leslie, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
I do. I have a website, lesliedunsondowner.com, where you can see a bit more about the book, and there's some excerpts about the different words.
Wonderful. And, hey, Leslie, thank you so much for joining us. I've picked up a lot from this interview. I didn't realize the depth of the language, and for that, personally, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me on. Great to talk to you.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms, and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. So true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday I don't know how.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Barry Thompson with us. He's the author of 90 Days to Success as a Small Business Owner. And let us say, Barry, hi. Welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Michael Ray. It's glad to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, a small business owner in today's world, there are so many small business owners, people starting, and the big problem that they have, they get a great idea, they do something, and then all of a sudden, they don't know what to do. They need somebody to hold them by the hand to say, here's next step, the next step, and the next step. That in and of itself, Barry, is probably the magic for somebody to be successful today. Somebody who's been there, done that, and say, do this.
Well, you sort of learn by doing, but if you haven't done it, then you have to learn from other methods. Either you read a lot, you talk to some people, you find a mentor, but you really have to make that commitment in the beginning that no matter what happens, you're going to keep going forward. And that's what most of the successful small business people have done, made that commitment and stuck to it and find a way to get around some of these problems, not just back off and run away from them.
And absolutely. And by the way, one of the things that you say, which is critically important, is customer service. We just have forgotten it today. It's, associate number 363, and you walk in and they're staring at you and they're worried about something else and they don't even know that you exist, like the kids at the counter at the local, the checkout stand at the local market. As you're walking out, they say, have a nice day, as they're staring someplace completely different and they have no idea that you're there. Mom and pops seem to have died, and I think this should be a resurgence, because if you don't take care of your customer, somebody else will.
Right, absolutely. I mean, everybody seems to have these kids in there that have their own version of you want fries with that. But you really need to pay attention to your customers. One of my sayings I've used in a couple speeches is, it's time to stop listening to the news and start listening to what your customers have to say.
Yeah.
Go out there and meet them. Use their name. When you make a promise, don't break your promises. When you have the chance to upgrade things, to give them a little extra, whether it's a service or in your product, offer that freely and smile while you're doing it. Actually, your smile is your cheapest marketing tool. And a lot of people don't use it as often as they should.
No question about it.
Business hours are another thing. Some people have business hours because I want to work these hours. Well, maybe your customers don't want to buy during those hours. You have to be available when your customers want to buy, or your competitors are just going to take them away and do the things that you're not doing.
Oh, by the way, absolutely, and there's no question when it comes to that. And I really believe customer service in and of itself today is it starts with, you said it starts with a smile. It's just be friendly. You know, allow them to realize that they're part of what you're doing, and if it wasn't for them, you wouldn't be getting a paycheck. And that's one of the things that I've seen time and again. I'll use the market again. You walk into the market, and one of the kids are stacking something up on the shelf, and you ask them a question, but they're too busy because they're stacking things, and they don't realize they're stacking it for you because you're the one who causes them to get a paycheck at the end of the week.
Right. The customer's not an interruption of your work. They're the purpose of your work.
Sure.
And you should always say thank you. And I forgot to say this earlier. It's one of the things I usually say first. Say thank you after every single purchase. I don't care if it's 3, 5, 10 years later at the cleaners. Thank them every time. They may not remember that you thanked them, but they're going to remember if you don't thank them.
And there's that appreciation. And that's exactly what you're talking about. If somebody feels appreciated, they're going to come back. If they don't feel appreciated, they're not going to come back. Now, the other side of this is that, you know, there's something called a value proposition, you know, why you're different than anybody else and why your customer should buy from you instead of the guy down the street. One of the ways to find a value proposition, and this is brilliant because you're doing this, when you say know your competitor's strengths and weaknesses, know what the other guy's telling the world about them and why they're different from everybody else, so you know exactly what you're dealing with out in the marketplace.
Yeah, your competitor, it doesn't matter if they're bigger, smaller. You just have to find a little better way of doing something. That value added that the customer is going to recognize. If you don't have anything added and you're the same as everybody else, what does it come down to? At the lowest price, and you don't want it to be that way. You want to have them buy from you from other reasons other than price. A fair price for what they're getting. But you need to know what your competitors are doing, how big they are, do they have products that are just patented or you can't possibly sell that same product, so you find something that does the same job a different way, whether it's a product or a service. How do they price? I always like to price in the middle. Never be the lowest, never be the highest. Price in the middle and then give them that little extra value. And then you need to know how they treat their employees. If you have competitors, go into their store and be a shopper. They recognize you. Hire your relative to go in there. Make sure you're on their mailing list. If they're a corporation, buy one share of stock, and you'll get all the information that ever comes out mailed to you. You'll know exactly what they're doing. And that's the way you find things that people want that they're not doing. So you can just add that to your service. You know, competitors are out. There's room for everybody. But you want to be the winner. So you want to make sure that you know what everybody else is doing so you can be the winner. Same thing in sports or anything else. When you watch a football game, which is just starting now, and I'm a big football fan, those defensive coaches know exactly what that other team is doing so they can come up with their plan to win the game.
Now, by the way, one of the things that is hit in the last few years that allows somebody to get a step up in the field so they don't have to go out by themselves with a particular product and et cetera, is franchise. And I know you've been doing a lot of franchise coaching, and that's most important to a lot of people. They don't realize the power of a franchise and that collective strength behind a product or a service.
Yeah, well, franchises are great. If you get the right one for the right purpose, for the right person, and you make sure that you get the best advantage before you sign the agreement. Because the franchisor is going to put everything to his advantage inside the agreement. But you can ask for things and they will change it. Like if you're planning on opening a second location, why should you pay that entire franchise fee all over again? You can either get it down to very low or nothing. And how about if you maybe have a business interruption. Let's say Irene, the hurricane, blows your store down. You're not going to reopen for 2 months. Many of those franchise agreements have a minimum you have to pay every month. You can always get a clause in there that says if there's a business interruption, I don't have to pay that minimum. And if you don't do that up front, you're going to end up paying later. There's $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 worth of things that you can get changed that I always advise people to look for. And if you ask for 20 things, they're going to give you 10 of them. So you're going to save a lot of money by knowing how to go into it and making sure it's the right business for you. It might be a business that has to be open 12, 14 hours a day, and you only want to work 8. Well, that's not your business unless you're going to train someone and you trust them to run that business. But are they going to provide the same products and services that you are? So franchises are great if you do your homework in advance. Not afterwards, because once you sign the agreement and pay your franchise fee, it's over. Then you might as well make the commitment to do the best you can to run the business. The franchises are good if you do it the right way.
Barry, in the last 10, 15 years, obviously we've had a transition in the way businesses are run, the way customers look at businesses, and so on and so forth. What stayed constant, though? What is it that, you know, from 50 years ago that you can always guarantee yourself that's going to be constant in the business?
Well, getting close to your customers, knowing who they are and letting them know who you are. You know, building a trust, I think, maybe is the right word, is having people trust you. No matter what happens, they can trust that they're going to get a fair deal from you no matter what. And you want to build that trust over time, and loyalty, so that people keep coming back. The small businesses that made it through this recession, and this was tough, but I'll tell you, and I have a business myself. I'm not just pulling these things out of air. I've actually gone through most of these situations. The people that reorder and come back to your store or add more services or visit your website, those are the ones that are going to get you through the tough times. And everyone's out there, maybe they're thinking, gee, I got so many customers, I don't have to worry about anything. Well, believe me, it changes quickly during a big turndown like we had a couple of years ago. And we're still not out of it. But there are some places that just didn't make it through because maybe they just didn't have that loyalty from their customers or they gave up before they should have. I forget who it was that, I think it was Ross Perot that says, how many people give up on the 1 yard line right before success is there? You got to keep going, and you got to build loyalty with your customers. They're the ones that always get you through it if they have that loyalty.
And by the way, I think one of the most important things, quote unquote, you know, is the customer, obviously, because that's where the revenue comes from. But there's another side of this to look at, Barry. With the customer itself, there are people out there today going, you know, the economy is falling down, so they got to go out and get more business. They got to shore themselves up. They got to make sure that they're going to have X amount of dollars at the end of the month. So they go out looking for new customers, and where they should be taking care of the people that they already have, because that's where the strength and that's where that stick-to-itiveness is going to come from the customer support that they have. I think you're spot on right with this.
Yeah, well, a lot of it is, there's an old saying that says your best prospects are your current customers. And those are the ones, first of all, you want to take care and make sure that they're happy. And how do you find out? You ask them. Just because you're the owner and maybe you have 12 people working for you doesn't mean you can't call up some of your actual customers or visit them out in the store and never be too busy to talk to a customer. Then you can find maybe new things that people want to buy that are already buying from you. And you ask them, what other products or services would you be interested in? And then you go out and find those products or services. This way, if they're buying them anyways, you can eliminate them going to somebody else who might be after your part of the business. So you need to work with your regular customers. It's always good to be looking for new customers. Because of attrition, you're going to lose some that are, you just can't control some of that stuff. But you always want to be taking care of your current customers and keeping at least 90% of them every year is a number that I like to look at. And if you do that, then you're going to add more revenue and you're going to grow by getting new customers. But always take care of your current ones first.
Now, by the way, you said something magic a moment ago when you asked somebody, you know, the what. Because most of us don't ask. You know, if I ask somebody, they may think that I don't know what I'm talking about. And I think that's garbage and should be thrown out the window. I think you're spot on. Ask them, what do you want? What is it that keeps you with me? What is it that you want to see? And just let them talk. And if you let them talk, you're going to find that additional income that's going to keep you stabilized through this economic downturn. I think it's critically important. Now, economic downturn. Getting out of financial crisis. There's a lot of people involved in that. What's that first step? Where do you go with that?
Well, we all run through this after a period of time, unless you're, I was going to say unless you're Bill Gates and Microsoft, but he had the same problems on the way up that the rest of us have. He just went a little farther than all of us. But no one wants you ever to go out of business. If you get into a financial crisis, you have trouble paying bills, suppliers, things like this, they will work things out. It's when you don't answer the telephone, you don't respond to their queries about what's going on, that's when they have a problem with you. Most people will work things out with you. You know, we went through this 2 years ago, and I said, gee, our phone bill's too high. You know, and somebody, a friend of mine said, oh, the phone company will never make a deal with you. Well, I called them up, and they did make a deal with me.
Yeah.
Because we were a customer for a long time. They said, we have a new plan. We'll cancel your old one. We'll put you in a new plan. It saved us $150 a month. I mean, that's just one thing. You can reduce your expenses. You can sell off some products that you really are not best sellers and maybe get them where you can ship them from the manufacturer instead of buying them and storing them. You keep marketing. You never stop marketing and putting your word out there. Now you can use social media, which is next to nothing in cost. Where you put a Facebook page and you make sure you have a blog and you post on it every day and you give out useful information, and then at the end of it or somewhere on the blog you always say if you have questions, if you want these products, tell us what you're looking for, and you have a suggestion. I'm big on suggestion boxes. You can put one on your website, on your blog, in your store, and make sure you put a sign on there that says we read every suggestion, so people don't think they're just wasting their time putting stuff in there. And by showing people you really care, you can possibly get out of this financial crisis. And if you give loyalty to some of your suppliers and you get a little behind, and it's happened to me many times, they'll work with you most of the time. And they'll partner with you almost. Because, first of all, they don't want to lose what you owe them, and they don't want to lose you as a customer who's going to keep buying from them. So they have two reasons why they want to see you make it and get through this thing. and banks. Everybody will restructure debt and defer it, and all you got to do is ask questions. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't run away. Stay there and work it out.
Oh, no question about it. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website that we can find you at?
It's idealetter.com. There's all kinds of things on there. We do a newsletter called the Idea Letter, and we're happy to send out a free sample. Just send us a little link on there where it says request a free sample. It doesn't cost a penny. Just give us an address. We'll send it out, or an email address. We'll email it to you. We've been doing it since 2002. We've been doing the same newsletter. I don't think we've ever made any money on it, but we enjoy doing it. It also brings a little attention back to us.
Wonderful. I've got to go, but thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Copy a couple times. And my blog is barrysbusinessboosters.blogspot.com, but I think it's on your website, so nobody's going to remember it. From that.
It's four or five times a week,
and there's all kinds of new ideas on there, things you can possibly use for your business.
Barry, we got to go, and I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Okay, it was great being here. I hope I gave some ideas and success to every small business person.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
All I have are these arms to enfold you. And a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Diane Collins with us. She's the author of Do You Quantum Think? New thinking that will rock your world. She's an original thinker and one of the foremost thought leaders of our time. Her life is dedicated to people living spirited, joyful, and masterful lives through leaps in awareness and the expansion of their approach to reality. She's a master of translating ancient wisdom into modern quantum terms that provide a practical and transformative platform for the way that we conduct our business and our personal lives. She consults executives in the world's leading corporations, as well as enterprising entrepreneurs, celebrities, students, and evolutionaries in the groundbreaking system of new thinking, and she created Quantum Think. Diane, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael Ray. I'm absolutely delighted to be here.
Thank you so much for being here.
You know what? I'm laughing because I was listening to that introduction and I was thinking, wow, that sounds rather audacious.
Yeah, but I like you too.
Good.
No, this is great. No, it's not audacious. If we don't know where it comes from, you got to lay a base of what it is that you're talking about. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
No, I'm not. Go ahead.
You want me to start with that right now?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm on your side.
Okay. Well, everyone knows that we're in a time of rampant change. And, you know, people are getting stressed out from three conditions that we can distinguish that everyone would agree to. One is accelerating pace of change, which in fact is a scientific fact, and there's no indication that things are going to slow down. Secondly, that we have the increasing complexity, and you know the number of choices we have is overwhelming, as you know, because of technology and communication, social media, et cetera, et cetera. Then we have the nice little fact of nature and humankind that we have every day this unfathomable uncertainty. So when you take all that together and you realize, as I did, we're in a new time. We're living in a quantum age where the conditions that we're living in, the knowledge that we have today about the nature of our mind and how we can create results using the faculties of mind that we've never been taught in school, by the way, then you realize we have been conditioned to live and think according to an older time, the industrial age view, where it was one-dimensional, it was a limited way of thinking, it was everything according to the five senses, and when you think about it, why do we see and react to differences? Because our whole orientation is around a worldview that said only physical matter is real. So we really have no connection to the word holistic, that we really are interconnected and interrelated. How we do connect through invisible fields of intelligence and energy, mind to mind and mind over matter, literally. So we're kind of in this state of overwhelm. We're in a quantum age, still using industrial age thinking, and it's not working.
Let me ask you this. Then when we talk about quantum age thinking, let's expand beyond, obviously, what we consider consciousness at this point. We live our life based on what we think logically we see out there, and our reality is based on what we've been told, and what we've been told forms what we think that we're seeing. Most people try to be the best somebody else. I can't possibly be the best you, because you're the only one that could be the first best you. But if I'm going to try to be as good as you, Diane, then I'm never going to be myself. Now, if I start to think that way, it causes me to think in every other area, my personal life, my business life, my whatever, that is diluted, and I just can't do it. And stop me if I'm wrong here, but what I'm hearing you say is if you go beyond what you think you could think, then there's a dimension that's open to you that you haven't even seen before. It's there. You just have to know how to step outside of yourself and see it.
Exactly. And, you know, what I actually did, and this is what Do You Quantum Think is all about, is I'm distinguishing the principles. It's actually a new system of thinking. It's very specific principles. They're simple. When you read them, you recognize them in yourself. And I get letters every day from people who go, oh, my God, you're saying, you know, what I've been feeling. So what you're saying is a very important point, which is that a lot of the thoughts we have, you know, what's the difference between industrial age thinking and quantum thinking, this new system that I invented? Most people don't even realize we think in a system. The whole universe is made of systems, everything from the planets to our traffic system to, you know, the grocery aisles in the grocery store to your own body. We live in systems, and we think in a system. So we imagine that these thoughts that you're talking about, that people have, like, you know, I'm not good enough, or I want to be like that and I can't, or, you know, whatever it is that stops us, that limits us, most of the time those thoughts are not even our own. So we can make a distinction between thinking, which is a conscious act, a deliberate, aware, and awakened act, and thoughts that just visit. So we are living in a world of thoughting, we could say, yeah. You know, what you are referring to, Michael Ray, that has been conditioned. How did the industrial age condition us? Well, think of it. Think of a machine. Once you set it up to work, it runs on its own. So in many ways, I'm not saying we're machines or trying to insult anyone, but in many ways we've become very automatic in our thinking. We've become limited by our limited scope of what we know about how we actually can access the kind of results we want to create, including getting past the either-or, the gridlock that we see in the world, its politics, and many other places, including that in ourselves. So when you can distinguish the limits of your own automatic thoughts, which I call least action pathways, least action pathways are the way the energy goes, the thought goes, because it's been that route before. But the very basis of the quantum reality, which, you know, quantum thinking is not about science. It's about how we can use the discoveries of science to recondition our own thinking to be more in sync with the world. So when the fundamental view of the quantum world is that there are no absolutes. Nothing is fixed in solid matter, as they once believed in the 17th century.
By the way, where that's fixed in is in our past. And most people, Diane, go through life, you know, with their hands on the rearview mirror. They're staring down the street and they're looking behind them and they're getting into a lot of accidents, but, you know, forward. And I think the real problem here is called defense. You see something that reminds you of something in the past. There's an unconscious activation of a memory to something recognizable. So you defense out against it and you limit yourself in what you will allow, not what you're able, what you will allow yourself to think. Most of what you're talking about happens in 12% of that conscious mind. 12%. There's 80-some-odd percent, 88% of that mind and that brain that houses spirituality, that houses all of those things that brings you beyond what you thought you could do that we don't know how to use because we don't know how to access it and we don't know how to deal with it. Everything in life is about a chemical release out of that brain. And what you see, what you experience is going to either control you or let you go. If you don't feel threatened, you move. If you feel threatened, you block yourself up and you protect.
Yes, and you can learn to interrupt those patterns. Now, sure. I know that you know a lot about brain science, and you may also know that when you interrupt one of these neural brain connections, and you can do it very easily just by noticing what I call, I've just made up a distinction, it's borrowed from science, a least action pathway. So that instead of identifying with your thought, instead of believing your thought is the truth, which it isn't, it's just a thought visiting, so to speak. I say like birds flying by your window, you know, you don't hop on the bird and stick with the thought. You just let it go. When you can interrupt it, what happens in the brain is that because our brain is also a whole field system, when you interrupt a brain pattern and you open up your mind to a new level of awareness and you start using the front part of your brain, literally, what happens is there's a whole brain shift. So when I'm talking about quantum leap, it's not having a new idea or not measuring every single thought you have. You know, consider the agony of that, not to mention the impossibility of it, is that when it's a literal quantum leap to a new basis for thinking. Think of it this way. Not only are we thinking according to a worldview that has, for the most part, been proven inaccurate or at least out of date, that's the industrial worldview that has shaped all of our systems, our judicial system, our educational system, every bit of it down to our own how we are in relationships. Not only are we thinking in sync with, I mean, not in sync with the nature of reality as we know it at the edge of knowledge today. Not only that, we're thinking according to something that's made us quite automatic. This is what you're referring to. So when you can very simply become aware of those habits and not give them any meaning. Now, this is the most key point. Is that just because you have a thought, you don't identify with it as you. And as you're talking about, Michael Ray, then you go to those other higher areas. People refer to it as the higher self or higher consciousness. What is that? We all have that, because where we have the power to choose is when we can watch those thoughts and choose something else, choose a new intent.
It's also called repurpose, and there's a vibrational aspect of this also. If you and I get along, that means vibrations. That means we're mixing, we're matching, we're connecting with it. If it's a different vibration, you're never going to be able to speak to anybody.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have we had a client in one of our programs in Quantum Fig, and she was in a business that her family didn't approve of, and she didn't like to talk about it. So she was holding in her vibrational field what you're talking about, because we're all in a vibrational field. I mean, the simplest way to think of it is you walk into a room, everyone's happy, you know, you're happy, and you connect. You walk into a room and you're miserable, everybody else is happy, and you're going to find yourself at the corner. So, you know, everyone can relate to that. But this is a fact of science, is that we're always emanating what we're holding vibrationally in our own being. So this woman, once she was able to shift those automatic thoughts, that automatic way of, oh, you know, my mother doesn't want to hear about it, my sister, my friends, they don't want to hear about my business. Once she saw that those thoughts were not the truth, that she could interrupt them, that she learned the dynamics of mind, there are faculties of mind that we don't learn about in school, how to use the power of our own intent, how we use what's called non-local mind to go using our intuition to connect into intelligence that's surrounding us and to send out intelligence. Because let's face it, if we can no longer function in a step-by-step linear process, we can no longer function that way. So what you're talking about, when we know what our vibrational state is and we shift it, that causes a whole field shift in the relational field. And what happened is this girl told us, and it looks like magic, but it's not. This is the nature of reality as we know it at the edge today. And it happens to be matching ancient wisdom. So what happened for this woman, name is Vicky, is that she started having people come up to her. You know, everybody wants good business results. People started coming to her and saying, tell me about your business. I'm interested in what you're selling. That's a true story. And I have, you know, hundreds of these stories where once people get in touch with their own automatic ways of being, ways of thinking, and learn the principles that actually give us access to what we want to create, what we want to attract, there's a whole system jump. That's called a quantum leap. You have a shift in your whole way of seeing the world and your whole way of thinking, and there's no visible, discernible pathway. How did it happen? It's a shift of consciousness.
And by the way, let me bring that down to a real easy way to be able to wrap our arms around that. You and I are standing in a room together, and you are standing very rigid. You got your feet together, your ankles together, your hands are at your side. You're very rigid. And I'm standing in front of you, and I put my hand on your chest, and I push you back. Now, you're going to fall over because you're very rigid. Now, the same thing happens again. This time that your feet are apart, you got your balance, and I push you with the exact same amount of pressure. You're not going to fall. See, the difference here basically is this. With a shift in position, everything is the same, yet the entire world is different. So what you're talking about is a simple shift in thinking. You shift the thinking, you shift the vibration, you shift the vibration, you shift the outcomes of your life.
Absolutely. And I love that very graphic and very real example, because that, you know, it's true in the physical domain. And as you know, that relates to your emotional, your spiritual, and all the rest of it. And so you do have that whole system shift. And so, you know, what happened to me, Michael, is that when I was growing up, I heard that phrase, you know, and people think of it as New Age hooey. Now we know from science that it's not. As you think, so you become. And so what led me to create Quantum Think is I started thinking, as you think, so you become. Well, how does that happen? Thought creates reality. If all you had to do was change your thought to change your life, to change the world, then why does the world still look like it does? Because let's face it, there has, for the most part, even though we've advanced, obviously, technologically, you know, medicine and all the different ways that we know that civilization has advanced, as human beings, we really haven't, because we're still manufacturing weapons to kill one another en masse, you know, under the saying, well, we have to defend ourselves because there's
Diane, I have to hold you. We're starting to run out of time. I could talk to you all night long. I could, but do this. Do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book or sign up for the course?
Yes, I do. It's Diane Collins, and that's DianneCollin, as in Nancy, S as in Sam, .com. And you can, there's a lot of information about my book there, but the great thing that we're doing is we're doing twice a month what I call Ultimate Study Group, a free teleconference for readers of the book. And we get in and we do coaching and distinguishing and sharing with people from all over the world. So it's DianneCollins.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Diane, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time.
It was great. Thanks a lot, Michael Ray.
Take care. Good night.
That's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening